Lehman Belcher and Donnelly. It's about 6 o'clock on May the 2nd. And the first matter on the agenda is current resolution 27 and the representative of the chairman of the Senate Banking Economic Development Committee is here, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do you want to address the committee, Senator?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. The resolution is very simple. It's a result of consultations with those people who have the experience and the expertise in the housing market to provide the legislature with counsel on the topic. The thought is that the best way to deal with the housing question is to have the legislature review very detailed and solid findings of the administration next January. There's no question that we have a number of questions regarding AHFC as well as the other programs that ought to be addressed in detail and hopefully in one piece of legislation that we have the entire session to look at, to think on, to take testimony on. This resolution calls upon the administration to conduct between now and January their research, their hearings, and to present to us a report of their findings and suggestions that they have to make. I've talked informally with them, and I know they wish to do that, and they probably will, regardless of the resolution. And I think it's the best approach. I really do not think that having the legislature involved as a part of the process, other than as an interested observer and possibly to raise questions, is the best approach. We need to preserve our constitutional role to look at what the administration has done and craft our own legislation and pursue those concerns that we think are important to the public.
Okay, questions for the Senator? Senator Lehman?
Senator Rohde, several weeks ago, and it may have been several months ago, I'm getting lost now in the time, but we passed a bill changing the name of the Alaska State Building Authority to the Alaska State Housing Authority. I don't know if that has passed the Senate already, but if so, we might want to change that in here.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the point's well taken, Representative Lehman, and Mr. Sharpe, you should get lawyers ready.
I've been around these lawyers here for the last 4 months, and they're honing me. The other, if I can continue, Mr. Chairman, is the travel in here seems really high, and I just wondered why it's about 75% of the total amount. Are there a lot of people making these trips to several locations?
As you know, the bulk of the state's housing programs are located in Anchorage. The seat of state government is in Juneau. Also, Fairbanks and Juneau are the ones that are involved. And also, in addition, it looks disproportionate because much of the cost on the administration side will actually be from their already allocated budgets. So the additional cost that we're suggesting is largely in travel, saying, please get it done.
How many people travel on these trips?
It'd be difficult. You're talking about a significant number of state agencies. The Housing Marketing Council has a number of people that pull in the private sector as well, and that is, in my opinion, the largest factor in raising travel costs. So, but it's important to have it.
Is it a dozen people, 15, 20?
I don't recall the exact number. They're on the Housing Marketing Council, but they're more than that on the Marketing Council. The membership is almost 30. The net was drawn fairly wide to encompass a significant number of people. And I might add that those are largely private sector people.
Okay. Further questions? Is there any member of the public here to testify on this legislation? What's the role of the committee?
Mr. Speaker, I'll move that this SCR 27.
Thanks for the promotion, and is there any objection? Hearing no objection, motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. I'd like to bring up SJR 8. Is there somebody from Senator Halford's office here? about SB 191? Do you want to, we'll pick up SB 191 then.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Judy Knight, Deputy Director for the Employment Security Division, Department of Labor, and this is Mark Mickelson from JPBA.
Community Mutual Affairs.
Okay. This bill we worked on jointly as at both departments, and what we it does is fund a state employment training training and employment program by using the employment contributions or diverting some of the employment contributions from the UI Trust Fund to target on specifically those people who would be drawing against the fund. Section 1 of the bill details the labor market and supply conditions in the state that lead to the finding that a state training program is needed. And I might add that Alaska is one of the few states that does not have state funds supplementing federal funds for training programs in the state. Section 2 of the bill provides for a 2-year pilot program for a state training and employment program. Section 3 establishes an account with the Department of Administration to deposit the revenue and also requires separate accounting and so forth. Section 4 is really the funding mechanism for the bill. And under Section 4, notwithstanding AS 232290, we would add an additional tax of 0.1% for employees who are covered by unemployment insurance. At the same time, we would give a credit of that equal amount of 0.1% to that employee for unemployment insurance purposes. And this has funding mechanism has been done in several other states. It does pass federal muster. And furthermore, in this section, we would limit this to the contributions received from July the 1st, 1989 through June 30th, 1991, which corresponds with the 2-year pilot. There would not be an increase in cost to employers. It would not be an increase in cost to employees. But it would give a funding mechanism to enhance the current training programs that are being administered by the state. The Employment Security Division and Job Training Partnership Act, individuals in community and regional affairs work very closely together to try to maximize the training opportunities that are available. In Section 5, we talk about the target populations. And then Section 6 defines the services that would be provided under the program. And Section 7 and 8 outline the duties of the Department of Labor as well as the Department of Community and Regional Affairs and also the State Job Training Coordinating Council. And it's estimated that these funds would be split between the current SDAs in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Balance State, so that they would be available equally and equitably to all residents of the state. Mark, you might want to talk a little bit about the target population.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This particular program, we believe, would foster new jobs by encouraging businesses to locate in Alaska by improving the skills of the existing labor force. A lot of folks who have become laid off due to seasonal downturns or closure of certain types of businesses or obsolescence of skills. Under the proposed eligibility criteria, there could be as many as, we estimate 60,000 people that are in that category, where we would, of course, focus. Language was changed over in the Senate to make sure we're focusing on people who are most in need. The training programs funded by this act would supplement existing funds and would not duplicate any existing programs. The current federal funding, at this point, we estimate only reaches 5 to 6% of those potentially eligible for those services within the state of Alaska. To avoid duplication and to maximize efficiency, the funds will be granted by the Department of Labor through the State Job Training Coordinating Council, which oversees the statewide operation of the JTPA program, and as Judy mentioned, would pass them on to the service delivery areas. The focus would be to provide services to Alaskan residents who are unemployed and received or exhausted unemployment insurance benefits during the past 3 years, are employed but will be displaced within 6 months, or have worked in covered employment sometime during the last 3 years and are not eligible for any unemployment insurance benefits. The types of training services to be made available for eligible persons would include, but not necessarily be limited to, industry-specific training, such as what occurred with the Greens Creek mining operation here in Southeast, or similarly in Anchorage with the Federal Express. Approved apprenticeship training, on-the-job training, where we reimburse an employer up to 50% of the participants' wages for a period of time while they're learning the job. Institutional or classroom training, and the different types of support services, such as necessary tools, work-related clothing, or safety gear and equipment. An example of that is we've been working with some of the displaced, burned-out trappers up in the interior. Due to the extensive fires there in the previous season, some of them lost all their equipment and everything else. And we had been able, under one of the JTPA sources, to provide that type of assistance. This program would enable us to provide an expansion of those services and reach a different client group that we cannot reach under the Job Training Partnership Act program. Might mention that our fiscal note we have before you, there's a slight technical change in the backup regarding the use of federal funds, and it's as it's related to the operation of support of one position. The front page and the total line itemization is not affected. But we would offer some clarification. Some folks in the Senate had a hard time understanding our intent, so we promised that we'd take care of that, that detail.
Okay, questions for the witnesses?
I didn't understand that last comment, and I assume you're talking about the labor.
No, I'm sorry.
CNRA fiscal note. You said there's some federal funds that don't show up on the fiscal
That's
note.
Correct. We
do you have a new fiscal note?
We have major changes on page 4 of 5, where we delete reference to the federal funds and we reduce correspondingly the appropriate amount under which we would provide the personal services support for the 7-month equivalent position. Originally, we were confusing in terms of how we had that.
The front page doesn't change. That is correct.
Oh, it was just,
yes, okay. It's page 4.
Mr. Chairman, are you ready for a motion? I think this is a great bill. I was frustrated that the administration waited a little longer than I had hoped for introducing the bill, but I think it's a good bill. It's long overdue. It's going to provide lots of opportunities for new jobs and entrance of new, hopefully new businesses to the Alaskan marketplace, and I think we ought to try to expedite it and get it rolling so we can vote on it this week on the floor. Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass out CS4, Senate Bill 191, with individual recommendations.
Okay, before we do that, is there any member of the public here to testify on this legislation? Okay, if there isn't, is any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection to the motion, motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Great. We're going to take up SCR 28, the Housing Finance Task Force. Ginger? Ms. Rabbit, you want to join us?
Thank you.
You want to address the committee on SCR 28?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Abbott, and I'm on the staff of Senator Ulan, the Finance Committee. Mr. Chairman, Senator Ulan wished he could be here, but because of the Conference Committee and some of the meetings thereafter, he's not going to be able to attend today. If he was here, I think he'd encourage you to support SCR 28, which is a relatively straightforward proposition that the legislature and the administration work together over the interim to develop some recommendations regarding the future of housing finance programs here in Alaska. As all of you are undoubtedly aware, there's a lot of confusion out there is in terms of the various programs the state offers, the status of some of those programs, financial and otherwise, that are currently on the market, or some of which have been closed down, some of which are proposing to be reopened. This resolution would create a task force, a vehicle that would allow members of the legislature, both House and the Senate, as well as what we would consider some of the more appropriate expertise from the administration to work together, study some of these issues involving AHFC, the Housing Assistance Loan Program, and the ADA Residential Loan Program, and work towards some consensus and ideally, perhaps, if appropriate, legislative solutions during the next session of the legislature. There's no funding appropriate, or there's no fiscal note for this task force, Mr. Chairman, and it's designed to sunset upon the presentation of a report within the first couple of days of the next session of the legislature.
Questions?
Or is it Wade? Does it contemplate also looking at the permanent funds portfolio and their lending?
Not as currently drafted, Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyer. The permanent fund is primarily a secondary purchaser of mortgages and, in fact, does not make the mortgages themselves.
That's actually not correct. I have two mortgages
in
the permanent fund.
In terms of their current aspirations,
right.
We're trying to deal primarily with ongoing programs here in terms of possibilities of restructuring and perhaps dramatic changes as much as privatization, or at least an examination of current policies towards those agencies. And that's why we chose to leave the permanent fund out of that at this point.
Mr. Chairman, one other question. How much is going to be requested, though, of the leadership of both houses to help fund this? These things won't happen by themselves. I know you didn't have this one, but what is the anticipated take out of the either leadership accounts or the finance committee accounts?
Speaking for the Senate specifically in this case, there is anticipated to be no draw specifically associated with this program. Staff time that would normally be associated with the finance committee and the other offices that may work on this would be considered sufficient to support the efforts of the task force. And the same would be true of the administrative elements as well.
Mr. Chairman, that probably gets to the real root of my concern about this. I served on a task force that was not unlike this one during the last legislative session. We had no funding and consequently did nothing or very little in the interim that would that affect housing. Of course, the charge is a little bit broader, a little different. Here we were just constituted by intent language, but I would have hoped that we would have seen some outside, outside meaning external to the legislature, review of these policies. I think absent an external review of these policies, all we end up with is with a whole host of politically motivated recommendations back to the legislature to make political decisions. And I'm not sure that that's in anybody's interest around the table here. And just a voice of concern for the record.
Representative Collins.
Well, I'd say, Representative Boyer, if his comments are accurate, then I would say that a lot of the resolutions and things that we pass and task forces and committees that we pass and shouldn't be funded.
I agree, absolutely.
Okay, any questions for the witness? All right, is there any member of the public here to testify on this legislation? You can stay with us, Mr. Abbott. discussion? What's the will of the committee? Maybe we'll move.
I move that we move SCR 28 out of committee with individual recommendations.
Any objection? Any objection? Motion carries. Thanks, Mr. Abbott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
SCR 8. Is Teresa still around?
Yeah, I am.
Oh.
I wasn't trying to be argumentative or anything. It's just that I think we need an external review on this particular thing because it's become such a hot issue over the years, and it started out to be that way, and then it became something else, something less than that. I don't think we can get there with an internal staff review. I mean, it's a staff work project, I think, and I don't normally like staff work projects. Except for my staff.
Oh, I didn't even know you were precious.
Yeah.
Oh, I used to do that a lot, you know?
Yeah, she
uses them with sympathy. I see her every time she speaks.
Yeah, it's my sympathy measure.
Yeah, just this time of year.
Please pass this bill. I'm in pain. Just kidding.
Okay. Go ahead.
Certainly. Good evening. Representative Donnelly, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Macer. I'm here for Senator Rick Halford, who unfortunately is elsewhere in the building and couldn't be here for this hearing. I did want to inform you that Senate Joint Resolution Number 8, Rick became aware of this concerns that were out there last year when he was chairman of the Finance Committee, and was very concerned that as a direct result of the failing Alaska economy, some individuals were being taxed on their losses. So I know that all of you have heard stories about the individuals who have lost their homes as a direct result of the economic downturn here, but what you may not have heard is that some of these individuals are being held liable for taxes on those losses. And what this resolution does is suggest to the IRS that we change what is known as discharge of indebtedness income, that they address it in some form so that those individuals who are being taxed on this discharge of indebtedness income, which is actually essentially a loss, do not get taxed on that loss and see it as a more fair way to help the economy in Alaska and help those individuals that are struggling through this economic downturn. I don't know exactly what more I can tell you about it, except that if an individual has a recourse loan, which is a loan where they are personally held liable for the debt beyond just relinquishing the property, they can be held liable for discharge of indebtedness income. And it's treated as gross income or ordinary income by the IRS, and therefore they're being taxed on a loss. Senator doesn't think that that's a very legitimate way to for the IRS to be treating Alaskans, and is trying to encourage them not to do this.
Are other folks who are relieved of their recourse debt? I mean, debt that has recourse, to which someone has recourse, are they treated in the same fashion as we're talking about here? Say someone has a business and that they have a recourse note, $100,000, and through some settlement negotiation, whatever, they're relieved of that debt. Are they also under the IRS code held for that part of the term of art is?
Right. The difference is that on a home loan, of course, we do have included. There are some cases where an individual can have a commercial business or a commercial enterprise, and if they depreciated their, if they took a high rate of depreciation, then they could be included in this legislation, and it was amended on the Senate floor to include those people. However, the main difference for most cases is that there's no deduction allowed for capital gains or capital losses, in this case, for a personal residence. And that's where the problem comes in on someone's home. You can, if you have a commercial enterprise, deduct your capital loss. You can't do that on a residence. So that's where your main problem is. However, there, like I mentioned before, if you have taken an accelerated rate of depreciation, sometimes you can be caught in the same trap. And it was amended on the Senate floor to include those individuals.
What happens to the person who had a home that was 15 years old and during the boom time owed $20,000 on it, refinanced it at $100,000 to take an $80,000 rate, and it happened a lot during the early 80s, therefore ended up with a debt of $100,000 on the new note, and then went through foreclosure, still had lived off the fatted calf, the $80,000, and refinanced. That's the kind of people that were the IRS is interested in catching are the people who took a rake through a refinance. I mean, it's unfortunate that other people also get caught in that trap, but isn't that the real intention behind the IRS's taking theirs to catch those kinds of folks?
I'm not sure whether those individuals had a recourse loan or not, so I can't tell exactly whether these people would fit into this resolution. I do know that the IRS was very concerned about this same problem when we brought it to their attention last year. They were working on getting it resolved administratively. They think they have sort of tried to, they've worked something out, but the individuals that I have been talking with at the IRS feel that it does need to be brought to the attention of Congress, not just an administrative change, and suggested that we still move forward on the legislation. There was some controversy within the IRS itself as far as the exam function and the public services function having this similar kind of dispute. I don't know whether the IRS would change it to not, whether they can work it out so that those individuals aren't caught into this same, so that they can protect the individuals that have experienced a real loss and not those individuals like you mentioned. I assume that, because Congress would have to make a change if to address this question.
Mr. Chairman, aren't all home loans recourse loans in as much as they're all potentially able to go through a judicial foreclosure? I mean, that's what, I mean, then you have real recourse to the person's assets, other assets.
It's my understanding that all loans are not recourse loans, but that some of the loans in Alaska are recourse loans, so I really don't know exactly, but it's my understanding that all loans are not recourse loans. And this really addresses those loans that went through non-judicial foreclosures, not judicial foreclosures.
That's right, because I think that's the term that makes, they're all potentially recourse loans if you go through a judicial foreclosure. Those who, I mean, when you don't go through judicial foreclosure, there is no recourse. That's, so the recourse is through the judicial branch.
Right, in a lot of these cases, of course, there were so many foreclosures in the state of Alaska, they weren't going judicially on all of them.
Yeah, we are.
Ready for a motion, Mr. Chairman?
I have one question, if I could. Chris, maybe you can answer it, or maybe somebody here. I'd like to follow up on that question on refinancing. When we refinance, what are generally the rules that apply? Can we refinance at 90% of the value of the home, or 80%, or
70%?
This is 70.
Somewhere 95. So
it depends on 95? The financial institution.
Somewhere 95.
So conceivably, if it were 95%, then the home value wouldn't have to drop very much to get in the predicament that people would be in here, where there may be, what's it called, a discharge of indebtedness. But at any rate, it would be through no fault, necessarily no fault of the person who refinanced. It's necessarily, it would be a marketplace function that would cause it to happen.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. The point is that someone who only owed $20,000 on a home had the, you know, because he bought the home 15 years ago, in 1985 decides that there's a major difference in what he owes the bank and what the market would bear for the home, goes out and gets two separate appraisals. Appraisals come in at, let's say, $100,000 a piece. Let's say the bank he's dealing with says, we'll finance up to 80% of the value, so it's $80,000. Difference that he owes the bank, he makes $60,000 on the transaction. The market goes crazy. The next spring, he loses $60,000 value. The house is now at the real value against $20,000 or $8,000. So now be down to $20,000 again. He's taken the money and run. He's played with the money. And all of a sudden he owes the IRS. Well, he should owe the IRS for taking the money. $60,000 of cold cash. He's converted to personal use. Ought to be taxed on it. That's what I think. I mean, I think those people legitimately ought to owe the IRS. They've taken money, and utilized money and not paid any taxes on that money. Therefore, and anyway, that's one group of folks. There are other people that aren't in that situation, that didn't take advantage of the marketplace that way, that you're also trying to protect here. So, thank you.
Further discussion? Is there any member of the public here to testify on this legislation?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Boyer?
I would move that we pass out SGR number 8 with individual recommendations.
So, any objection? Any objection? What's carried?
And the Senator did ask me to thank the committee members.
So, go ahead. And you, watch your step.
You're welcome.
I'll do that.
I imagine you're here to testify on HB 286. And Ms. King, you're here on that too. Do you want to go ahead and we'll bring up 286 and take some quick testimony on it? I don't think it's the intent of the committee to move the bill today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Risa Gerald. I'm the Director of Governmental Relations for Associated General Contractors of Alaska. While the AGC is very supportive of safety and has safety programs for our member firms, we have some major concerns with this legislation. We
would suggest that if the goal is for improved workplace safety, there might be some other ways to approach the problem. The federal government and several states have, federal government last year passed a drug-free workplace legislation that requires notification, all sorts of different things, to hopefully avoid some of the workplace problems with alcohol and drugs, and several states have done the same. Some of the provisions that they have provided in those pieces of legislation is requiring a written alcohol and drug testing policy to be presented to the employees at business. If you don't drink on the job, you don't use drugs on the job, that sort of thing, you have to notify them. Some have job application testing, some have provided random testing, and some have reasonable suspicion testing and discipline. And then some states have come up with a major drug awareness program, problems with it, how you can hurt yourself. Secondly, interestingly enough, as you well know, the penalty for a violation on a work site goes to the employer only. There are times that employees are the cause of their own problems, and be it get an OSHA violation, citation, but it still goes to the employer. In British Columbia, they did a real interesting thing. Whoever is responsible for the OSHA violation, the employer, the supervisor, the employee, or somebody not related to the work site, if they cause a OSHA violation citation to be issued, they're responsible for paying the penalty, the causer of the violation of things. So we would seriously consider, possibly, if the bill is going to move out of here, is work with the committee in the interim. We have several AGC committees in Anchorage that have focused on these types of issues. And let's, you know, if there's a problem out there, let's improve the workplace safety and with the penalties. I don't know when the last time the penalties were raised. Maybe they do need to be raised for inflation. I don't know, but that would be something we could talk about and come up with something to actually improve the situation and everybody could be happy with. There was a bill in here on front pay that everybody had worked on and came up with a happy solution, and we all went marching down the street together. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Okay, questions for the witness? David, you're not on there.
Another picture taken.
We will.
A and B.
Are there any questions for the witness? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Richard Arad. I'm the Deputy Director for Occupational Safety and Health at the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor supports this bill. The bill basically increases the penalties for various classifications of occupational safety and health violations by 300%. The reason this reflects the inflationary increase since the penalties were first established in 1970, we believe there's a need to provide an incentive for employers to correct violations. We believe the present penalty level doesn't provide this incentive, that employers many times take it as a cost of doing business rather than trying to correct the violation before an inspection is conducted in the worksite. It should be noted that we do have in our program a voluntary compliance or a consultation and training section that we provide to employers to correct violations. And we believe that if this bill passes, that this service will be used more readily by employers. A good employer who has a good safety record, who's conscientious, is not going to suffer through this bill, because basically if you do not find violations, they won't be penalized. So it's to really try to get the attention of the employer who does not have a good safety program, encourage that those types of employers to have better safety programs.
Okay, questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several questions, last year we changed the workers' compensation law, and in that bill, and I could be wrong because I didn't sit on the committee last year, I thought there was an increase in the penalties for violations, and also, I thought that as part of that bill, there was an incentive program in that bill to assist or encourage employees to be more safe. And what is it? Is that correct, that the penalties were changed with that bill last year?
No, the penalties for occupational safety and health violations were not changed by that bill. There was a mention about encouraging insurance companies to try to get their clients to have safety programs, but I really don't know. It was through the Division of Insurance, and I'm not sure exactly what happened to that or what has been done for that provision. I know it was only a one-line provision. It was sort of like an encouragement type of
Representative Collins, the safety incentive program was taken out somewhere along the line, whether it was in the conference committee or something. Further questions? Thanks for your testimony today. Is there anybody else here to testify on this legislation? Ms. Gerald, could I ask you one question on the record? I was just wondering, we had talked earlier, and you had called down to AGC in Washington State, and I was curious whether they had experienced any problem with business in the state, people not wanting to do business in the state because their penalties were so much higher than ours. And
my notes would be this time. I spoke with Dick Briscoe, who is the executive director of AGC down in Seattle, and he said no, that nobody had gone out of business and they hadn't seen a disincentive for us. He was aware of people coming into the state. He serves on the Governor's Construction Safety Advisory Panel, and said that they haven't had any changes in their accident rates or anything of that nature due to these new penalties going into effect. What they have found with this panel that he serves on, he said, was that education seems to be a key to have a well-educated construction crew that knows what the hazards are, knows how to use the safety equipment, how to help remove front guards, frissons, things of this nature. And he said also they're finding that drug and alcohol are also a major problem, that somebody goes out at night and they're still hungover the next day. They're just not as functional or as sharp. And they are looking at all sorts of approaches. They don't know how to approach it because there's some states have tried some things and they have worked. There's been some Department of Justice memorandum advising how to put together a program. The NLRB has gotten involved in it. With some advisory things from firms that are union and how you have to deal with the unions if you do want to institute the program. So it's, he said that education and improving the drugs and alcohol problem is
done. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, well then it's our intent for the moment to hold on to this legislation probably over the interim and work on it and try to address some of the other safety aspects, maybe roll them in here in some sort of package. So we'll be seeing this bill again. There's nobody else from the public here to testify on that bill. We'll take up House Bill 225, Disability Insurance. Is there anybody here to testify on that legislation?
Mr. Chairman, we did hear this bill in the HES committee, and what it does is assure that if the insurance companies make a mistake and pay the insuree instead of paying the provider of the service, that the insurance company has to then come back in and repay the provider of the service, so that you don't have doctors who are providing care or dentists or any other health care provider, any provider of care, for something and have the insurance company make the mistake of paying the the covered person, and thereby in some cases keep the doctor provided the care from receiving the service. And it would only occur in those situations where when you go into the doctor's office, you ask for the dentist's office, whatever it is, the provider of care's office, and you sign on the insurance form, remit payment to the provider of care. We've all seen those kind of forms. If in that situation, then the insurance company, by mistake, sends the claim or sends a check for payment to the beneficiary of the insurance instead of the provider of care, but it's then the responsibility of the insurance company to make the provider of care whole in that instance. And I think it passed out of Hess with almost, well, I think it was almost unanimous. I don't recall there was any dissent.
Is there anybody here to testify? 225? Whoever's in the comments?
Well, most of the physicians in Alaska, dentists, everybody requires cash for services. It's hard to anybody anymore that really allows people to, that will just accept the insurance payment. And it's for the very reason that I think you're talking about, is that they want to make sure that they get paid. Because a lot of times, when the insurance company sends the money to the individual, the professional doesn't see it. I guess the concern that I would have is, I would just, there are still a few doctors who, you know, give their patients some flexibility, and I would hate to see that change. If this would anyway do that. Did you get any concern from
that issue was brought up, and this would only affect those situations where the patient assigns his payment to the doctor. And then it's clearly, if the insurance company makes a mistake and sends the check inadvertently to the patient rather than the doctor, then it's the liability of the insurance company. That's all it is. I think it is, like, as you said, a very narrow opportunity there.
Was it about you?
No, Virginia, just through the chair, it surprised me. I think I've only had to pay, write out a check once or twice at the most for any medical that I've had. I'm glad I'm going to the right people.
You've probably got in the same position for a long time. I know I had the same thing, but I don't think that, I mean, I don't ever have to pay cash, but I've gotten that position for dentists and things for a long time. But I think if you're relatively new and you don't have any history with them at all, they'll ask you to pay cash. And that's I've seen that. That's one of the things that really blew me away when I moved to Alaska was that when I came here in 1975, everybody had a sign that said, you know, we accept cash, and that really offended me, but it continues to, you know, to exist to a pretty great degree. And if you've known the doctor for a long time and they don't do that to you, they will accept the insurance payment, but there are very few doctors I think that do that. I mean, I go into a lot of doctor's offices and I always see that little sign that says,
you must have an honest face.
Okay. Well, what's discussion? What's the will of the committee on?
Mr. Chairman? I would move that you pass out HB 225, the CSS, individual recommendations.
Any objection? Any objection? Okay. All right.
Buried down there is HB 168.
It is, and we're working on a committee substitute, and I'm going to bring to the committee sometime.
Get out the shovel.
Yeah.
Hospital 146, physician licensing.
Oh, we've decided to hold on to it, right? There's Hospital 146 is a physician licensing bill that we've got a proposed committee substitute before the committee. I think the committee might, I don't know if we adopted it or not as the committee substitute, but we said we'd like to hold on to that over the interim and work on it in addition to the other legislation that we handed out last week.
We just today received a very extensive house labor.
Well, I guess we didn't. We had about four or five pieces of legislation that were put before the committee last week, or was last week? Or Tuesday, uh-huh. Or was it Thursday? I'd like to go ahead and introduce those as committee bills.
I have an objection to some of those bills. I'm not going to hold the committee up if you want to do it, but I don't want to be associated.
Okay. Then I'll make it clear that they were not by unanimous consent that those bills were introduced. Representative Boucher.
Mr. Chairman, on HB 168, may I just...
168?
168. I know it's not on the table, but it's in this pile of stuff here.
Oh, which one is it?
May I just get a reading from you on this? You said this is a committee substitute. When did this come into committee here?
Gosh, I don't even
know. About the 24th of March. Is that correct?
Might have been. I don't know what they came with.
I'm just wondering, you know, we can subcommittee these things to death.
Well.
And you're the chair. You and I have our... Which is good.
Well, why don't we stay
too fast.
Why don't we stay and talk about it, and I'll go off record so we don't have to keep minutes on conversation.
Okay. All I want to know was just know sure. When...